All right, we'll start soon here. A few others might filter in. First, to make sure, does everyone have a Bible or is close to a Bible, so you're good with that? And
it's written on our hearts.
Right? It's written on your hearts. Well, sure. well, if it isn't, it's here on a sheet of paper. This is my translation of Philippians 2:5-11 with different annotations in it. And you can take a look at that and take it with you if you want. If not, please just leave it here and we'll use this for the rest of the week. And so what I'm trying to do in this, in my translation, is try to expand a little more on the terms that might not be totally familiar with us. And so it's kind of an interpretative translation, and also some of the structure that's in Philippians, and that will help us in our study of that text. And so today we're going to get right into the text itself. So what we're looking at is Philippians chapter 2, verses 5-11. And I'll give you a moment to read that in your Bibles if you want, or read it in terms of the translation that I've handed out. And then we'll start talking about things. All right, a little background here for Philippians chapter 2, verses 6-11. Verse 5, as you see, is kind of a lead into it. Verses 6-11 are what most scholars consider to be an early Christian hymn that would have been sung or recited by the Christians at Paul's time and even earlier in worship. And we know, because obviously Paul is quoting it here, that this hymn is very important and central to the understanding of what it is to be a follower of Jesus at that time. What we don't know about this hymn is if Paul made any changes or additions or emendations to it, right? Because we don't have the original hymn itself. And we do know, as we see in our own hymnal, that, right, at times we change words in hymns and things like that to maybe make a different point. So maybe Paul was doing that as well. So we don't know if he changed or didn't change anything in this hymn. But one thing we do know, because he used it and develops this throughout Philippians and in his other letters, particularly in Galatians and Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, this hymn has very significant terms and understandings of what Paul thinks the gospel is all about. And as we'll see as in studying this more closely, that this hymn tells us not only what Paul thinks about Jesus, but indeed Paul's understanding of God, who God is and what God does for us. And one of the key terms in all of this will be the term of self-emptying. The Greek word is kenosis, and we'll talk a lot about that in just a little bit. But again, this is key, Chris, for Paul's... for Paul's sense of Christ and God. And so, as we begin to look at this, again, the hymn itself is divided into two stanzas. Right. Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 and 8 would be the first stanza or the first verse, and that talks about Christ's humiliation, humbling, and all that that involves. And the second verse, second stanza, is verses 9 to 11, and that talks about his exaltation. And again, one of the ways that we can tell that there are two verses here, or two key parts, is that, of course, the topics are very different, humiliation and exaltation. But even more so, the way verse 9 starts, right? Therefore. So you know, right, we're coming to a conclusion. There's a different thought that's going on there. So you go, oh, all right, new thought, new verse. The second thing that's there is that in the first verse, verses 6 through 8, the first stanza, the subject is... Let's try something else here. The subject is Jesus. In the second stanza, the subject, first of all, is God, and then creatures or creation. Right. So that again, to note that, right, that's why we go to verse 5. If you go back to verse 5, right, let the same mind be in you, that, right, is in your mindset of one who thinks in Christ Jesus, who, and then note all the verbs that are going to be there in verses 6, 7, and 8, talk about Jesus. Verse 9, the subject changes, right? God has exalted him. And then in verses 10 and 11, every knee shall bend. And where are those knees? They're in heaven, earth, and beneath the earth. So it means all of created existence, the whole cosmos. And then in verse 11, every tongue. So we're talking here about language, or again, every nation, every ethnic group and identity that you can think of. So those are the creatures, that's creation. So because of the subject change, we say there are two stanzas to this hymn or poem. So that's our background. Now, for the rest of our session today, we're going to pay attention to verses 6 through 8. The first stanza, the part that talks about humiliation. And if one looks at this closely and looks at the grammar that's there, so all of you English majors and English teachers can now be happy because we're going to do some grammar. Right. The pattern of these verses follows this. It starts out with although, and then there's a clause there. That's what I designated by A. So if you look at my translation there, right, in chapter 2, verse 6, although, and it can also be translated because, we'll look at the because thing later, although, then A, being in the form of God, and the second part, not be. So that's the second half of verse 6. Did not consider his or this equality with God as something to be exploited for his own advantage. If you have the NRSV, it just says as something to be exploited. And that's true, but again, we have to, I think, be a little more expansive of that, because why are you going to exploit it? You're going to exploit it for your own advantage, right? So, you know, it's the kind of thing where Jesus didn't say, well, hey, I'm equal with God, so I can do anything I want. Neener, neener, neener. Right? Or na, 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 whatever. Right? Didn't do that. Didn't do that. Huh?
He wasn't big into neener, neener.
He wasn't big into neener, neener. That's right. So if he did not do that, then what did he do? But, and then if you see C1 and C2, those are those other verbs, verse 7, but he himself, he emptied, and again, that's the way the grammar goes, in order to put the himself first shows emphasis, right? In terms of very intentionally doing this. It isn't that it happened to him, but it's what Jesus himself did for us, right? Did it in his freedom, did it in his love for us. He emptied himself. And what does all of that emptying mean? Grammatically, there's where you have your participial phrases that help. That's the words that are in italics in verse 7, right? By taking the form of a slave, being born as human, being found as human. Right? That explains emptying. But there's a second part to but. Verse 8, experienced humiliation, and how was that? Becoming obedient to the point of death. So we've got although A, not B, but C. And that, if you will, that's a pattern, that's a formula. And we're going to see today how Paul uses that for Christ, but we'll pick up some more on that tomorrow to see how Paul also uses that formula with regard to himself and understanding what it is to be an apostle, and wants that formula or pattern to apply to us. And it comes through, if you remember, in many of Paul's letters, Paul says something like, be imitators of me as I am an imitator of Christ. So what is that imitation? What do you do? Well, what Paul wants to do is say, do what Christ did, what I do. Now you folks should do this too, so that although you're A, don't B, take advantage of it to be more exploited for your own advantage, but C, whatever that might be. And right again, as Paul talks about that, there are different things that go under C. To look at this in a little bit more abstract way, the A is always going to talk about our status or Christ. In other words, who we are. So again, generally you can say, although you are baptized children of God, let's use that one. Don't exploit being baptized children of God for your own advantage, right? In other words, baptism doesn't justify selfish acts on your part, whatever. But you engage in selfless acts. Or again, the very general concept of all of that is love, right? Love one another as I have loved you, for example, would be John's gospel for saying that, right? The way you see this worked out in Paul, If you want to do the grammar thing, you look for a concessive participle and conceding, right? That's like an although. And then you find out, okay, what's the negated verb? What's the not whatever your verb there is? And then you try to find, now where's the but? And then you look for the affirmative verbs. So that's kind of the grammatical key for how you can read Paul and pick up all of this kind of stuff. And so now when we see this happening here in Philippians 2, 6 to 8, the A is in the form of God. The B is not exploit equality with God. C1 is the emptied himself. C2 is the humbled himself. Okay? So everybody's kind of following that. See how that...
Does Paul, Paul uses logical reasoning like this all over in his writing?
Wish he would, but...
Yeah, well, but is this structure repetitive?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And we'll...
Does he have other forms that are repetitive as well?
He does, but in terms of this one with respect to how specifically the actions of Jesus are the actions of the apostle, are our actions, always follow this formula. And so again, in my language, and again in terms of the title for this week's session, it's what I call cruciformity, right? This is the pattern for how we have a cruciform Christ, a cruciform God, a cruciform church, or a cruciform community of faith. And we can take it right down to each and every one of us, right? Because all of us are to be cruciformed to Christ. That's Paul's goal for us.
And your definition of cruciform again is?
We haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, okay.
So that's a really good question. And I won't spoil it, right?
Okay.
But again, sneak peek, right? The understanding of cruciform involves what emptied himself and humbled himself is all about.
If I corner the market on gold, I have to give it all away.
You don't have to give it all away, but the question there is, did your cornering the market on gold, was the intention and purpose there simply to exploit that for your own advantage?
Of course.
Well, then it's a problem.
Well, I was thinking of the emptying oneself.
Yeah. No, that's not necessarily in terms of giving away all material goods.
But not using the power of it.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions and comments in terms of the nuts and bolts of this first stanza?
So you could just read it backwards, though, as far as the instruction he's given.
In terms of doing but, not, although?
By being selfless.
Oh, I see.
And not exploiting.
And by.
You'll be closer to the form of that version.
Yeah.
You could, although Paul never does that. He's really very consistent in sticking with it in this order as well. All right.
Yes, and that emphasizes the giftedness of life.
Yes.
The other way is I'm still in control.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So again, emphasizing in that sense the selflessness of all of this. Okay, to put it within a Roman context, and that's in the little blurb, and of course here is the Latin thing, cursus pudorum and cursus honorum. Cursus simply means course or path. Pudorum is the Latin word for shame. Honorum, of course, is honor. Right? So that for the Romans, there are basically only two paths in life, in terms of your goal in life. You would either take the path of honor, which of course you all should take, or, right, if you are a, you know, person of bad character, evil character, so on and so forth, it means that you will then take the course of shame. And that what we have here is when we see Jesus emptying himself and humbling himself, right, to the eyes of any Roman or in any Hellenistic culture in that Greco-Roman world, that would be the way of shame, as opposed to the way of honor. And in terms of this notion of honor, if you are going to be truly, fully, completely, and totally on that way of honor, you would be divine, which is, of course, what the Roman emperors are. And the title for reaching the top of honor is you would be entitled Augustus. Right. And remember, Caesar Augustus. Augustus isn't his name. It's his title. His name is Mark. His name is Octavian, adopted son of Julius Caesar, and so Caesar family name and all of that. But because of what he does and how he traveled the path of honor about 12 years into his career as emperor, he was given the title Augustus. Now, and here of course is the most valuable thing of this session, I am going to tell you how you too can become divine. It's a fourfold process, right? And I'll
I said if it involves the cross, though, I don't know.
No, it doesn't. See, that's the great thing about it. Okay. Step one is you must show acts of piety. The Latin word for that is latria. Does latria sound like anything familiar to you? Latrine. I know. So you see, in terms of this first act and the notion of latrine, if you are a plumber, or Chris, as you've been working here on all of this water stuff, you've got to step ahead of us here. Because what latria or latrine basically means is simply a public work.
Oh, see here.
There you go.
It's his title.
It's his title.
How about the first step?
So now, right, we could change his name. That instead of director of public works, he can just be director of latrines. There you go. Now we're on the path of shame. No.
Let it mellow.
So if he
If he does it long enough, then we call him Latria Augustus.
Yeah. You know. So, and again, okay, what piety is for the Romans and all of that is you need to do a public work, something that's good for the public, which, again, in Rome, it might be bread and circuses. So you throw out a whole bunch of, you know, Olympic games, gladiatorial games, or whatever in the Colosseum, and that's something. But, of course, the greatest public work you can do is build a temple to one of the gods. And, of course, that's what Octavian did. So again, in our way of talking about things, piety in terms of philanthropy might be, you know, paying for the building of a church or some other public work. That's step one, piety. Step two is, this is where it gets a little tougher. You need to wage war. Right? Because, of course, Rome or whoever would have enemies. And that there are enemies, and those who want to defeat you or enslave you is to your shame. And therefore, to bring honor to Rome is to engage in war, in conflict against your enemies. And so you do that.
The American way.
The American way. The third thing, which is kind of obvious, but in waging war, you need to be victorious. Because if you wage a war and lose, that's not very honorable. Right? So you need to win the war. And of course, I'm sure you've seen in movies or TV or whatever, you know, when Roman emperors go out there and they win the war and then they all come, or generals, and then they all come back to Rome and there's the big parade and the conquered are in chains and all of that. And of course, if you're victorious, that means your enemies are what? Enslaved. That's the sense of shame. And again, here we read, right, how Jesus, in emptying himself, took on the form of a slave. So that in this whole honor system, you can see Jesus is a big loser. Because Jesus doesn't take the form of the victor. He takes the form of the one who is defeated. Right? The one who is conquered, not the conqueror. And then, of course, if you are victorious, then you have contributed to the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. Right. And again, you can see why, at least again, as it came into Canada under the George Bush administration, there were those kinds of allusions to the U.S. as, you know, empire, an imperial kind of foreign policy, and the reason for going into Iraq, Afghanistan, all of that is, of course, what they are going to do is bring peace to the Middle East and peace to the whole world. Right? Pax Americana, right? Pax Roma. So.
So what if you fail that phase? Because I think we did.
Well.
Path of shame. We don't get to be Tiberian.
You don't get to be Augustus.
America Augustus.
Right. So there you go. There's
country doesn't that idea. If we're following that format as a nation, does not bode well for us.
No.
Because Rome did not.
So but, when they talk about this Romana, is that that Rome is at peace and there may be wars away from Rome, and so you're not affected by it, or is there peace everywhere?
The goal in terms of the full understanding is that right, one who truly wages this war and is victorious ultimately will be such that there will be peace throughout the empire.
Because you've subdued all the challengers.
Now, right, that may not happen all at once, so that, once you've put down those uppity Jews over there in Palestine and whatnot, then all of a sudden the Brits over there in Britain, are going to put on their blue druid uniforms and attack you, and so now the war goes on over there. But at least as long as you keep doing this, you see your goal there is Pax Romana, and at least if you have fought one major battle that you've subdued the Jewish nation or the British nation or the Gauls or wherever you might be, then you can say you've contributed to the Pax Romana. Right. And so therefore, right, if you have completed all four of these steps, you're Augustus. You are divine, like the gods. And so as you can see in all of this, right, this is very political. And it's the political way of honor. I mean, we've talked about it in the U.S., but quite frankly, it's the political way of honor that just about any nation state follows, isn't it? Thinking that, or again, that whole part of our philosophy is that, right, war is necessary and a means to peace. And so therefore we can fight honorable wars and all of that, because if we are victorious, that means it brings about peace. Now, how true is that, right? That becomes the whole thing. That is the cursus honorum. That is the way of honor. And so, again, right, the sense here is Jesus isn't quite living up to that. That instead of this, he takes what from the Roman side of things would be considered the course of shame. And so let's look at that. And again, there are two Greek words here that we have to think through. Kenosis literally means to pour out. And that, thus the term, the sense of empty. So that, for example, you fill a container with water, and then you can kenosis it, right? You pour it out. You empty it. And so what we have here then, in terms of that first sense of Jesus, is that he empties himself, right? Or to think about that as pours himself out. Now, if we go back to our formula, right? Although he's in the form of God, did not think that could be, that is something to be exploited, but himself he emptied, or let's go with the literal notion here, poured himself out. And if we go to verse 7, for a little help, poured himself out, taking on the form of a slave, being born in likeness of human beings. So let's take this a little different in terms of first human and then slave. Okay, how is that pouring yourself out? Or no, not yourself, but Jesus. How is that Jesus pouring himself out?
Because he could have been master of everything, but he chose to be subject to everything.
Okay.
He's not striving to be a god. Augustus.
Okay.
One of the objections we have to enslavement and slavery is that it's dehumanizing. And so if he is pouring out his humanity and becoming a slave.
Okay, so that's why here I wanted to put slave a little below human, because it is dehumanizing. That's right. What's dehumanizing about being a slave? What's so bad about slavery?
You have no control.
Okay, no control.
You're relegated to being property.
Vulnerable.
Yeah.
You're subject to somebody else's wishes and commands.
Your life is not your own.
Anything else? That's pretty good stuff. You guys are sharp for 4 in the afternoon on a hot day. Anything else you want to think about slave?
It strips you of a will.
Okay.
I don't know, does it really strip you of your will, or do you still have it that you have to...
If you have, you have one, but it's rendered inert. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't...
You
it's
can't.
No longer
yeah.
important.
You have to give up your will.
Mm-hmm.
Or it doesn't matter what your will is.
Yeah.
So that makes me think about that Romans text again.
Right.
Things that you want to do, you don't do. And things that you don't want to do, you do do.
Your will is to do what your master asks. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, now comes the nasty question. Is all of the stuff you said about slavery true for Jesus?
No.
No? Then how could he become a slave if this is what it is to be a slave, but none of this is true for Jesus? Who's wrong here?
Who is he a slave to? Isn't he a slave to?
Exactly.
Who is he a slave to? Who do you want him to be a slave to?
I don't want him to be a slave at all.
Slave to the human family, to human condition.
Slave to the human family, human condition. Okay. Let's go back.
I think he's a slave to God, because if he was a slave to humans, wanted him to be, was the powerful king, the military king, that definition of king, and what he did was turn that on his head.
But is he a slave to God, or is he still God?
He did it by choice. He didn't do it because he had to. He did it by choice. That's different.
So if you do it by choice, then you're not a slave? All right, let's think about this. Remember, because slave is going to be in contrast to form of God, right?
Yeah.
Although he was in the form of God, he did not exploit that for his own advantage, but took the form of a slave. So you've got form of God, form of slave. And remember, we said that although the A part is a status, right? So the status, if you will, initially, we'll go back to our Roman thing here, if you will, his status was Augustus. But he did not exploit Augustus for his own advantage, but instead poured himself out and took on the status slave. Now, what is your status if you're a slave? Because indeed, right, there are some slaves. Remember, slavery is a little different in the Hellenistic world than it was in the antebellum South here, right? Because, you know, slaves meant that you were conquered. But, you know, the Romans had Greek slaves and, you know, some of those Greek slaves would educate their children, ran the whole, you know, land and so on and so forth. So, I mean, in some senses, they had a lot of control and their life kind of was their own often and all of that. So not all of these things would have fit for a slave in the Roman era either.
So a slave in the Roman era is basically a heavily taxed subject?
No. No, the slaves wouldn't have to pay taxes because it would be their masters or owner that would have to pay the tax.
So
that, I mean, one of the key things, indeed, if you will, one of the things that does it is they were property.
But they were also expected to provide or make value for their owners.
Yes.
And they were valued for that reason.
Right.
Sometimes that word slave is translated servant.
Mm-hmm. But here the word, I mean, there's two Greek terms often diakon, or what we would say nowadays, deacon would be the word for servant. Doulos is the word for slave. And here the word used is doulos. He really means slave.
And there is a difference.
There's a difference. There is a difference.
So you're talking about status. He started with God as Augustus.
Right.
And then and it says he himself and became human, but not just any human. He became the lowest, or he went to the bottom of the rung, to the outcast.
Right.
The person on the lowest of the low. So he went from the top to the bottom.
Right. So he's on the bottom of the status. One of the key things here, I guess we would say, is that indeed, if you are a slave, it means that you are not free. And that is indeed, one could say here, Jesus' condition. How is it that Jesus as slave, and if you will, as human, is not free?
I'd say in the sense of, like, not free to follow his own selfish ambitions or his own personal desires.
Okay.
Let me repeat the question one more time.
How is Jesus as human, and then, as Chris correctly says, take you to the bottom of the rung, because again, in that whole hierarchy of honor, slaves would be at the bottom. Not quite the bottom. We haven't hit bottom yet, but we're almost there. How is a slave who is, in terms of status, they're not free? Because here again, simply speaking, if you want to talk about status, highest status would be Augustus. Somewhere in the middle, right, would be the notion that you're the free person, right? You're a citizen, a Roman citizen. Paul appeals to that. And then the lowest class is you are not free, you are a slave. So how is Jesus a slave, or how does Jesus demonstrate that he is not free?
My will, but your will be done.
Okay. Aligns his will to God's will. That may or may not be a sense of freedom. How else is he not free?
Well, I guess I've always talked about the humanity, or the humanity of Jesus is that he, you know, we say he's God and human, and so he limits himself to be, a human body could not contain the glory of God if he didn't limit himself, if he revealed his true identity.
Okay. That's really philosophical. Well, no, it gladdens my heart. However, right, I think Paul here wants to talk about it still more experientially. How would you be not free?
He dies.
That's going to come under the humbling himself.
Oh, okay.
But
he's subject to the authorities of the Roman Empire. He allows himself to be subject to the authority of the people around him.
Yeah. Okay. Let's kind of generalize it. If you're not free, it means you are going to be bound to certain conditions. When Jesus pours himself out, what are the conditions to which he subjects himself?
He's not even welcome in his hometown.
Okay.
Shame.
Shame would be the general thing, but specific understandings there is, right, not welcome, or
rejected.
Notions of rejection. What else? Think about,
ridicule.
Right, just take yourself and, do your quick read through the Gospels. As you think about that, what are the conditions, and don't say death yet, because that's the humbled himself, we're going to get there.
Doesn't have property.
Okay, so there's rejection. There might be
poverty,
hunger, sadness.
Yeah, let me put it all under one great big word: destitution. Right, he's destitute.
What about challenges authority?
Challenges authority.
What about just being a baby? Dependent.
Or if you will, we'll say challenged by authority, right? Just simply being dependent, and that is indeed a form of being human, but certainly the lower you go on the rung, the more you recognize that.
Subject to betrayal?
No. Betrayal. We'll add here as well things like disloyalty. What else?
I'm thinking, I don't know one word, but like Jesus encounters people that don't believe what he's telling them, so he doesn't have, he's limited by our condition in some ways. Like he encounters people that he can't make them believe.
Right. Doubt and ridicule. Things I suffer all the time. What else?
He's dismissed.
Okay. How do you see that different from rejection? Or is it the same? I mean, it could be the same, it could be different, so I'm just asking for clarification.
Like, they don't even take him seriously in some cases.
Okay, yeah. And let me add one here. Again, this is, right, this is his problem all the time with the disciples, right? He's misunderstood. They just don't get it.
Well, and when I'm thinking of, he puts away the sword, Peter, when he's arrested, Peter wants to fight. He says, no, that's not what I'm here for. So he limits his power, his response.
See, Peter buys into the Roman system there, right? That's the whole system of honor, because after all, he does believe that Jesus is Messiah. Maybe not quite the Messiah that Jesus wants us to think he is, but certainly if Jesus is that political Messiah who is going to kick the Romans out of Israel, then what? Well, you know, step two, wage war. And we see that also in John's gospel, in the dialogue between Jesus and Pilate, when Pilate says, so you are a king. And Jesus says, if you say so. And then he says, my kingdom is not of this world. Or again, if you will, my kingdom, my reign and rule isn't the Pax Romana. It's not what you Roman guys think reign and rule is all about. Right? So there again, you see particularly that clash between one whose status is Augustus and in that sense, one whose status is slave. Coming under, right? And I think this gets at it much better, right? These are the conditions that Jesus pours himself out, or you could almost say pours himself into for our sake. Jesus takes on these conditions and takes on, if you will, the shame that comes with all of this, right? Of being rejected, of being destitute, challenged by the authorities, dependent, betrayed, ridiculed, not taken seriously, misunderstood. And then you have to ask yourself, if you know all of this is coming, why would you do that? Right? Why would you take the path of shame? There's two answers. Why you would do that is because, one, you are extremely stupid, or two, you're God. And again, Paul will talk about that in like 1 Corinthians, right, where God's wisdom is folly, right? The foolishness, what is foolishness to us is God's wisdom. Precisely this kind of thing, right? Not taking the path of honor is utter foolishness, not only in the Roman context, but for us as well, right? I mean, anyone want to volunteer for all of this? No, right? We'd say, you're stupid, you're foolish. Unless, right, Paul said, unless you're God. God goes this way. And then we'll go to the second one, humbled. And again, the sense of humble here, we'll do this two ways. This now, which is the answer that we've all talked about before, but it fits specifically under this. Humbling is death. But there's one step even below death, and what's that?
Crucifixion.
Death before dishonor. Death before dishonor.
Death before dishonor, precisely. Because, of course, right, there could still even at times be honorable ways to die. Or at least non-shameful ways to die, right? I mean, you just die because of old age, or you die because you have a heart attack. I mean, right? If you will, there's no shame in that. But, right, the whole sense of crucifixion, and again, why it couldn't be done to Roman citizens is precisely because it is meant to evoke shame. Right? That indeed it's a horrible, terrible, cruel way of dying, but the real purpose for it, for the Romans again, is it always happens in public because it is going to shame. And it is either slaves or subversives, traitors, treason, rebellious folks that are crucified. The whole thing there is that they are publicly humiliated. And again, as we read the passion narratives in all the Gospels, right, one of the key things that happens is that those who are there, right, mock and humiliate Jesus, right? If you're the Christ, come down from the cross. He saved others, he can't save himself. All of those kinds of things, the shame, the humiliation, and so on and so forth. So, oh my goodness. You're so patient. You're great. Last point. What are we talking about when we talk about the experience of shame? Or, again, if you read the Psalms, you often come across this phrase, something like, "Oh God, do not put me to shame," or, "Oh God, my enemies have put me to shame, but please deliver me from my enemies." Right? So that often it's we have been put to shame, or shame has been brought upon us. I'm sure all of you have experienced something in your life that you would characterize as shame. Don't want to go into any of the personal stuff, right? This isn't show and tell. But if you think of those incidents, how would you characterize that sense of shame that you felt?
You want to hide.
Okay, so if there's shame, you want to hide, which is precisely what Adam and Eve did in Genesis 3. What else is there in that experience of shame?
I'm getting this from Brené Brown, but she talks about shame and guilt. And guilt is, I did something wrong, and shame is, I am something wrong. And so it's an identity thing, and it kind of reminds me of going back to your earlier point of status, like, that's who I am.
Right. That is absolutely essential in understanding this. To feel shame and why shame is so much more devastating than guilt is because shame goes right to your very identity. Shame hits you at who I am as opposed to what I did.
So you're worthless.
So that's the bottom line on that. Your sense of identity, your sense of shame is a notion of worthless. You have no value. It leads to, again, the sense of despair. And right, despair, another way of saying that is you perceive not only the situation, but yourself as hopeless. And that's perhaps maybe the way someone has shamed you, and how you finally experience that sense of shame when somebody says to you, "Daryl, you're just a hopeless case." Right? Because if that's said, and that's said seriously and with sincerity,
as you experience that, you berate yourself. You know, if I was just smarter, I could have, or you know, if I would have known, or you know.
whatever.
Yes. Right. I mean, there's nothing in that sense. There's nothing more devastating than you could say to someone else than that they're hopeless.
Isn't that the human condition without God?
That's certainly what Paul is going to say. That's right. That when we think about us and who we are, finally, and that's why that sense of Jesus emptying himself and humbling himself not only talks about God, but talks about our sense too, because bottom line is human condition without God's grace and love at work leaves us feeling hopeless. Right. Gives us simply an identity of shame. And again, goes right back to Genesis 3. That sense, right, that and again in it's almost Hebrew humor, right? That the way in which Adam and Eve recognize, first of all, their hopelessness, their shame is, now they say, oh, we're naked. Right? Which again is, you know, kind of that thing, you know, if you look at yourself naked in the mirror and say, who I am, you kind of go, oh, I'm kind of hopeless in terms of this body. Yeah. But, and then the other thing is, once they recognize their shame and their nakedness, the funny thing is they make a little apron, a little loincloth of fig leaves for themselves. And the great thing about that, fig leaves, if you know anything about them, is they are very scratchy and itchy, right? They have the consistency, I understand, as Velcro. So think about this, right? On a nice hot day like today, wouldn't a pair of Velcro underwear be just the thing you want? Won't that be fun? Right? The sense there of what? The human being in the condition of sin lives in a constant state of chafing and irritation. No, that's what it's about. Right? Sin chafes, irritates, especially when you have to live together, because now, right, Adam and Eve, recognizing their shame, rather than being blessings to one another, they become irritants to one another. Adam goes, that woman that you gave me, it's all her fault. And that snake did it. Everything in all of creation is now an irritant instead of a blessing and a gift. And to think about that, if everything is an irritant in everything, boy, we're in a hopeless situation. Because no matter where you go and who you talk with, they're going to tick you off. Welcome to Holden Village. Especially the winter community, right?
Oh, man.
Where there are times, I'm sure, I mean, I've only been here for short times in the winter, like a week, so it's still safe. But I'm sure some of you long-term staffers have been in the sense in the winter where things seem a little hopeless, right? And we won't go into any details whatsoever. You know what I'm talking about. You can see where Paul's going. So that's...
But, yeah, and I think there's another thing to add to that is that when we go back to Adam and Eve and we run into a behavior, their behavior was inappropriate, wrong. But it's even worse when you're doing what's right and you experience that same kind of... attitude from other people.
Yeah.
Behavior from other people.
Yeah.
And that's what we see with Jesus. He's doing everything right.
And he's still getting shamed.
And he's, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the thing there is, it's hopeless if you do, it's hopeless if you don't.
That's the classic double bind, the hallmark of a dysfunctional system.
Mm-hmm.
So is it, Paul is saying it's the human system, but is it the Roman system?
It is the Roman system insofar as Paul would say, this is how it really works. And you folks who think you can follow the path of honor and achieve Augustushood for yourselves are simply living under illusion. And isn't that where many of us like to live? That, for example, for me, I don't know if you know my background, but I was born in the state of denial. And I really like living there. Right? And most of us
can't
do.
Can't wait to go home.
That's right. That's right. And I think Paul, I mean, that again would be Paul's, you know, criticism, or in that, you know, sense of preaching the law to the Romans, is that your whole course of honor is simply illusion. Right. It is, again, thinking you can justify yourselves, deliver yourselves from this hopeless plight in which you find yourself. And, of course, you can't.
So, but Christians do this. They have theology of glory. We have that catchphrase. But the idea that you can follow all the Christian rules and somehow become a better spiritual person, closer to God than that person over there who must not be doing it right because their life sucks.
Or how about theology of prosperity, that whole thing too.
Yeah,
it's right up there with it.
Yep, all of those things, right? Gospel of health and wealth, the whole kind of works righteous attitudes, theology of glory, and any of those ways in which we become the subject of the sentence talking about our deliverance or salvation are all of the ways in which Paul is, all those ways fall under Paul's criticism. Okay? That's enough hard work for one day. Thank you. We'll look now. Tomorrow we're going to pick it up and say, you know, we've looked here at what this says about human beings and what this says about Jesus. We'll take it the next step in terms of saying, because Paul wants to make this point too, what it says about God. And that'll be our topic for tomorrow. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. And thank, oh my gosh.